From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Stockton, California.
I live next door to Bob Saget.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Everywhere, I'm homeless.
Coming up, we get an elections roundup from the East Bay Express.
This is a historic election. There's numerous issues on the ballot, and there's the mayor's race and a couple of key city council races.
We'll also look at feminism through the eyes of a superhero.
I think there's this myth in Hollywood that if you make a film starring a woman that, you know, boys won't go see it, that there won't be enough of an audience, and that just seems ridiculous.
And we'll delve deep into the world of literature, really deep.
I did a wind it up fast, and I didn't really know how to do it, so here's what I wrote. So let's hear it for guppies.
Let's hear it for guppies. And now we're going to turn to the East Bay Express co-editor Robert Gammon to get the latest news. So, Robert, let me start with the decision by Alameda County prosecutors that they will not press criminal charges against the Oakland police officer who shot and killed 18-year-old Alan Bluford.
Yes, Alameda County DA announced that yesterday. They're not going to be charging Officer Masso. And basically they concluded that they believe Officer Masso's account, that he contends that when he shot the teen, that his life was in danger, and that so it was a justified shooting.
And there's a question from the family's point of view as to whether or not that gun was actually planted.
Right. I mean, the family contends, and there's some strong evidence to back that up, that this was a good kid. He's a Skyline High School student, and by all indications that this is an unusual situation for him. And so they've sued the city, and I expect that lawsuit will continue for some time.
And the Oakland Police Department has been under fire now for this last year and, you know, ever since the consent decree. There's an article in the East Bay Express today about the sort of lack of confidence in internal investigations within the OPD.
Right. As part of the request by two civil rights attorneys, John Burris and Jim Channon, for a federal receiver to take over the Oakland Police Department, they filed a lot of evidence last week. And among that evidence was testimony given by a consultant who said he spoke to commanders in the Oakland Police Department, and these commanders expressed no confidence in the department's own ability to investigate instances of police misconduct, both from the Internal Affairs Division and the department's Criminal Investigations Division.
And you can read all about that in the East Bay Express. I'm speaking with Robert Gammon, who is co-editor, and he's the author of this week's cover story, which is all about Berkeley being at a crossroads in this election. What's going on?
Yes, this is a historic election for Berkeley. There's numerous issues on the ballot, and there's the mayor's race and a couple of key city council races. The positions that the candidates have on a number of measures that are on the ballot really provide a great example of the competing visions for Berkeley. On one side, you have the pro-growth contingent, which is led by Mayor Tom Bates and city council members Daryl Moore and Lori Capitelli, who are running for re-election this year. And their vision for the future of Berkeley is to bring in a lot more people to live in downtown Berkeley and also live in West Berkeley. And on the ballot this time around is Measure T, which would do that in West Berkeley, would increase the population of West Berkeley. And they see that as the best way. If you bring in more people, they will, you know, be shopping at stores, they will be paying taxes, and so it's a way to grow Berkeley's economy without having to raise taxes on the existing residents there, or having to cut services further. And Berkeley already has very high tax rates, and it's been forced to cut services in the past few years during the Great Recession.
And so what's the competing vision to that, one of more development and tax base?
The competing vision is from anti-growth activists who have been really upset over the past few years about the direction that Berkeley has taken. They adamantly oppose the plan to bring thousands of new residents into downtown Berkeley, and they've also opposed Measure T, which would allow for more population growth in West Berkeley. And so they're running a spirited campaign. They're backing two candidates against Tom Bates. One is Jacqueline McCormick, who's kind of a political newcomer in the city, and the other is Chris Worthington, who's been on the council for many years. Chris is not anti-growth. However, he often ends up voting with the anti-growth crowd.
And Oakland, Berkeley's neighbor, is also looking at potentially significant changes to the city council. The biggest story is that the at-large council seat is being contested. It's currently held by City Council member Rebecca Kaplan, and current council member Ignacio de la Fuente is challenging her in this election.
Yes, it's the premier race in Oakland this fall, and it's unusual because de la Fuente, who's been on the council for 20 years, has decided to give up his own seat to run for another council seat. And Rebecca Kaplan has been on the council for a few years, and she's, according to a poll from Ignacio de la Fuente's own campaign manager, she's the most popular elected official in the city.
Then why would Ignacio de la Fuente run when he, by all accounts, been reelected to his own seat?
Yes. I mean, he definitely would be reelected if he decided to run again. He's won reelection numerous times by large margins and is very popular in his Fruitvale district. Before a debate last month, he told me that if he's running to become against Rebecca Kaplan because he hopes to build a coalition, defeat her and build a coalition to pass some of the measures that he's wanted to enact in the past few years, including a curfew in the city and an expansion of gang injunctions. People in City Hall also think that he's angling to become president of the council again, a position he held for about 8 years. And if you're able to do that, then he would be able to essentially block Mayor Jean Kwan's plans for the city because he disagrees with her on most issues.
Robert Gammon is co-editor of the East Bay Express. You can find all of their stories at eastbayexpress.com. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. San Francisco is in the middle of its biggest literary festival, Litquake. The city's top writers are reading from their best work all over the city. If you go to an event, you'll see some of the most glamorous sides of a novelist's life. The adoring fans, the recognition from fellow writers, and the joy of the spotlight. What you won't see are the lonely sides of the trade, the constant bouts of doubt, the writer's block, and the occasional really, really bad sentences.
Curse the people who cling to standards because they are afraid of the future.
That's Jack Boulware, co-founder of Litquake, emceeing an event that highlighted this other side of writing as some of the city's best writers got on stage to read some of their worst work. It was an event held by the San Francisco Writers Grotto to fundraise for this week's Litquake Festival. KALW's Martina Castro was there.
It's Wednesday night, and I'm at the Verdi Club in San Francisco. The show is sold out to a crowd of hipsters and glittering literati. I'm surrounded by high-pitched laughter and colorful cocktails. I feel like these people are somebody. Oh, shh, it's starting.
Guppy love. And why not guppies?
Oh, God. This is best-selling author Mary Roach. The guppies are from a column she wrote in her first job as a public information specialist at the SPCA.
And I'm going to skip ahead here to the last line because I had 600 words and I needed to wind it up fast and I didn't really know how to do it. And so here's what I wrote. So let's hear it for guppies. Thanks.
This is a piece of regretriture. Part literature, part stomach-sickening, face-wincing, skin-crawling regret. The kind of writing that, at a minimum, you should keep tucked away in your closet. That's where I keep mine. But it's better left deep under the house, collecting mold. Taking it out, reading it? Unthinkable. But that's exactly what 10 writers are doing in front of hundreds of people. best-selling, reputable writers whose work you can read in publications like McSweeney's, Mother Jones, and the New York Times. Like Jeff Greenwald, who reads from his first book of poetry.
I realized there is no radio. The seals are singing to the vanishing evening, barking through a pain I could never understand.
And it gets worse.
The inscription inside the book, which I saw after I picked this book up at Green Apple in the late 1980s, and I'm going to read the inscription to you. I didn't make this up. To Mom and Dad, with all my love, Jeff Greenwald.
Yes, you heard right. His own parents couldn't bear to keep his book, so they sold it.
Man will chop. Man will kill. He'll leave no trees left standing still.
The agony goes on. Award-winning journalist Todd Oppenheimer reads from a poetry contest entry, and Katie Crouch reads from her Hello Kitty diary.
I'm almost nine. I have red hair and would be a good friend, if I must say so myself.
Melodrama oozes from personal journals like Julia Scott's.
It's even enough to know that I am living in the same lifetime as he, let alone being in the same room.
Yep, this is truly embarrassing stuff. But the writers, they look relaxed, almost relieved to get a chance to read it out loud and laugh along with the audience at their former, less talented selves, almost as if to confess. But Julia Scott says she wasn't relieved until she left the stage, precisely because those words used to be so meaningful.
Parenthetical thoughts and kind of convoluted thinking and you know, things that were deeply melodramatic and you sort of don't know how it's going to come out until you say it, and you don't know whether the crowd is going to go along with you and find what you wrote so earnestly at age 20 hilarious.
But they did. People laughed until their sides hurt, and so did the writers, like Jeff Greenwald. He says in his line of work, you have to be able to laugh at yourself and be comfortable with humiliation.
You don't hear back from editors. You know, when you're lucky enough to get a rejection, it's always a disappointment. You write something that you think is wonderful, and then you hear back, well, this is great, but take all the good parts out. So it's sort of, you know, those of us who do this kind of work have kind of agreed to continually live that life. We must be getting something from it.
And the readers get something, too.
It's only when we sort of are really vulnerable that we're most accessible.
So all of this has me thinking about my writing. I write for radio. I wrote this very story you're hearing right now. And I could just end it right here. But I can see how you might think it's a little unfair of me to display other writers' worst work without sharing a little bit of my own. So I dug around and found a piece of my own regretriture, circa 1996. This is from my first book of poetry, and I use the term book lightly here. But anyway, here's a poem from my melodramatic days of age 14. Okay, here we go. It's titled Mortality. What is wrong with us today? Are we all too tired to play? Don't you feel? Don't you care? Do you understand? Do you dare? People die left and right, all through the day and all through the night. Do you think this can't happen to you? That tomorrow your life cannot be through? Well, it happens to everyone someday. We are all slowly but surely passing away. One day, everyone must die. Yet, most don't have a chance to say bye. Just remember how no one lives forever. Maybe then, your life, you can learn to treasure. Yours in regretriture, and just a little bit of regret. I'm Martina Castro for Cross Currents.
KALW is an official sponsor of Litquake, and we have two events coming up. Tonight, you can catch a live taping of the show Philosophy Talk at 7 p.m. at Z-Space. And on Saturday, the Hear Hear team will host a night of storytelling at SF Public Works, starting with a mixer at 5 p.m. You can find all of the details at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. While Litquake takes place in San Francisco, the North Bay is being entertained by the Mill Valley Film Festival. It's the 35th annual festival featuring such stars as Dustin Hoffman, who was celebrated last night, and such blockbusters as Life of Pi from director Ang Lee. It also showcases filmmakers like Christy Guevara Flanagan, whose new documentary is Wonder Woman, the untold story of America's superheroines. The movie features Gloria Steinem, Linda Carter, and others talking about feminism through a pop culture lens. KALW contributor Kevin Robinson asked Guevara Flanagan to tell him why she made the movie.
Well, the film was really an evolution of ideas. It didn't all come together for me at once. The first thing that happened was I saw an article in the New York Times about Gail Simone, who was writing The Wonder Woman in comic book form. And it mentioned that it was one of the first women to ever write the comic book, even though she's been around for 60 plus years. And that just struck me as odd. You know, here is this icon of great empowerment, and she's only been created by men. And there was some kind of contradiction in there that I thought was really interesting. And then I started looking at the history of Wonder Woman, and there was just so much fascinating stuff throughout the decades from her creation. She was a really radical creation for her time that still reads really powerfully today by standards of how women are still represented. And then she was on the cover of the first Ms. magazine. So there are all these kind of really cool touching stones throughout the history. And I thought I could use her to talk about larger issues of women's representation in the media.
So in the film, you talk about the role of women in comic books, the role of women in society. You mentioned the creator of Wonder Woman. His name was William Moulton Marston. Is that correct?
That's right. William Moulton Marston was a fascinating character, ahead of his time in many ways. He really wanted to create a pro-female character that was different from the Superman of that time. So instead of fighting with brawn, she could use a little bit of her sometimes feminine guile, but also just her powers of empathy and her search for justice. She comes from Amazons, which I think this is what I think is so interesting. So she comes from this matriarchal society where women are equal in all ranks. And I think it's what's fascinating about her to look at today, these early Wonder Woman comics, is that she's mentors other women. She's at the front of her story. So the whole mythology revolves around her. She's not a sidekick or daughter or love interest. And that's still really radical for today's representations of women, particularly in heroic roles.
Okay, going back to the 70s, Linda Carter, Wonder Woman, and she spawned a couple, I guess, positive female heroines in that era. One in particular was The Bionic Woman, starring Lindsay Wagner. Talk about her and that role.
Well, The Bionic Woman is really interesting because she was a spinoff of The Bionic Man, but she eventually became more popular than The Bionic Man. Although they were always really careful, who was known as the Million Dollar Man, to say not to put a price tag on how much she was worth, because she couldn't be worth more than the Million Dollar Man, right? And she was actually a character on his show and was killed off. And she says that they got all this fan mail saying, you know, where did she go? We really want to see her come back. And they figured out a way to resuscitate her in her character and then give her her own show. And what's fun about her, again, is that she, both her and Linda Carter as Wonder Woman, even though Wonder Woman's dressed fairly scantily clad. They really play the characters in this earnest, sincere way. And though it seems campy to our standards, they themselves, the actresses, really imbued these characters with a grace and a power and a thoughtfulness that I think still resonates for today.
Well, let's hear from Lindsay Wagner.
So it was not surprising in retrospect that the show was an absolute hit, just off the charts. This character was going into a man's world, into a man's job. But I used to say I didn't want to be a man running around in a skirt. I wanted, if we're going to do a woman in this type of a role, I wanted to bring up the feminine qualities, the feminine principles in our stories. Inclusiveness, conflict resolution, as opposed to just conquering or just settling it with physical prowess.
That was a karate chop.
I know, I love that.
I think she broke six boards in that scene. Chris, you mentioned the fact that Hollywood is not even 50% controlled by women as far as decision making. I think you interviewed Jemu Green and Jen Stoller.
The statistics are really surprising. They're a lot more dramatic than just, less than 50%. And we have two women that we interviewed in the film, Jennifer Stoller, who's an author of a book, Ink-Stained Amazons, and Jemu Green, who was the former director of the Women's Media Center, talking about these statistics and really the impact of these statistics.
Some of the most popular female heroes, say Wonder Woman or Buffy Summers, were created by men, and it's not that women aren't capable of creating these heroes. It's that the people who have the means to production have traditionally been men.
3% of the decision-making positions in media are held by women. That means that 97% of the decisions about how women are going to be portrayed, 97% of those decisions are being made by men.
That's a staggering statistic.
It is. And it's one of the areas where women have made few gains. That and politics, I would say, are just some really dramatic areas. But, I mean, if you think about it, the media is what particularly young people are consuming all the time, you know, whether it's on TV or in video games or in films. And it has such a big impact on self-esteem, on, you know, what they want to grow up and be, and even their education. So I think it's a really important issue to address. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that I made the film.
Chrissy, I like to close the interview with towards the end of the film, you have scenes from people talking about who inspired them. They mentioned like writers, producers, directors. Can you set that up?
Well, one thing I wanted to leave audiences with is what's positive out there. And part of what we can do to be positive about women's roles and women's as heroes is to reclaim the women that were our heroes that have done wonderful things throughout history, even in literature, even if they're not real characters, just reminding us of who the inspirators were.
In my childhood, besides Wonder Woman, Louisa May Alcott was my hero. Sid Charisse, because I wanted to be a dancer.
Eleanor Roosevelt. I loved Dinah Shore.
Ann Richards really spoke to me.
Bella Abzug. You know, she said stuff that rang true in my life as a 9-year-old.
When I would watch MASH when I was a kid, there were women's writers' names on it, and I'd see those names every week. And those are the names that made me say, women can do this job.
Strong women leave legacies, and the legacy is simply, if she could do it, I could do it.
That's Bay Area documentary filmmaker Christy Guevara Flanagan. She spoke with KALW contributor Kevin Robinson, who runs the website Medium Rare. It considers work of women and people of color in the media. Wonder Woman, the untold story of America's superheroines, is showing Saturday and Sunday as part of the Mill Valley Film Festival. You can see what else is playing at the festival by going to our website. It's kalw.org.
For freedom and democracy is
Wonder Woman.
That's it for today's Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Zoe Brezhne, Leela Day, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, Artyom's Kunahoffs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Nina Nicole Morente, Erica Moo, Stephen Short, and Ray Sue Sussman. Today's show was engineered by Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Car Share is on the web at citycarshare.org. Especially, though, thanks to you. Cross Currents is listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll learn how Proposition 32 might change the balance of power in California politics.
Prop 32 changes where the money comes from more than it changes where the money goes to.
How the campaign finance reform proposition will affect corporations and unions. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. If you're one of those people who enjoy the oldies, and we really mean oldies, then you may want to hear Voices of Music from San Francisco. This early music ensemble plays Renaissance and Baroque music written prior to 1800. They have two concerts nearby this week. They're at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in San Francisco on Saturday night, and then on Sunday night you can hear them at the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalists. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.